Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 27th of April, these are our main stories. The US and South Korea agree to cooperate on nuclear policy to try to thwart North Korea's progress towards an atomic bomb. A first direct phone call between President Xi of China and Ukraine's Volodymyr Zelensky since Russia's invasion. And the UN's envoy to Haiti says violence is expanding at an alarming rate in areas previously considered safe. Also in this podcast, the US government indicates it won't step in to save the latest struggling financial institution, First Republic Bank. And a whopping $69 billion doesn't convince UK regulators.
We got a hit on Hassan.
We can't take him in Iran.
He's not in Iran. Who do we send?
Their objections could scupper the biggest ever takeover in the world of video gaming. The United States and South Korea have again bonded over the nuclear threat from North Korea. A state visit by the South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol saw the joint announcement of an agreement called the Washington Declaration, allowing Seoul a say in America's nuclear planning. At the same time, a U.S. nuclear-armed submarine will dock in South Korea for the first time in 40 years. A meeting between President Biden and Mr. Yoon took place in the Oval Office, followed by a news conference. Here's Mr. Biden.
Our mutual defense treaty is ironclad, and that includes our commitment to extended deterrence, and that includes the nuclear threat and the nuclear deterrent. They're particularly important in the face of DPRK's increased threats and a blatant violation of U.S. sanctions. At the same time, we continue to seek serious and substantial diplomatic breakthroughs with the DPRK to bolster stability on the peninsula.
I got more on that agreement from Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington.
What the agreement does is set up a mechanism for consultation so that they can discuss these things. They get more of an insight into how the Americans are thinking about nuclear planning, and they have some input to it. But it would still only be the U.S. president that would make any decision to push the button.
And a U.S. nuclear-armed submarine docking in South Korea for the first time in 40 years. All of this is not going to go down well with North Korea and with its allies.
No, that's correct. Sending nuclear-armed submarines back to the region for the first time in decades is supposed to send a strong message of support for South Korea, although there's no actual deployment of nuclear weapons on the peninsula, and a message of deterrence to North Korea. But the more that you say that you're going to defend South Korea, I think the more complicated it gets to say to North Korea, we're not planning to attack, although that is always the message. That is also the message that was sent to China. Senior officials told us they had been briefing the Chinese about this plan, and they said it was very much directed at North Korea and North Korea's growing nuclear program, not at China.
And North Korea's nuclear program, well, it is widely believed to be on the verge of having nuclear weapons that it can mount on missiles. This isn't really going to stop that, is it?
Probably not. Really, what this agreement does is it reassures the South Koreans, or it's meant to reassure the South Koreans, that the American existing commitment to come to their defense, including with nuclear weapons, which is a treaty obligation, is very strong and it will happen. And it is meant to send a message of deterrence to North Korea. President Biden also repeated his offer for diplomatic talks, eventually leading to denuclearization. But the North Koreans haven't responded to that. Kim Jong-un has really gone all in on weapons production after his diplomatic efforts with Donald Trump broke down, and he's upgraded his nuclear weapons program. He's vastly increased his missile launches and tests. So you do have experts saying now, some of them saying it would be more realistic, really, for the U.S. and its allies to start talking about arms control with North Korea rather than pushing for denuclearization.
Barbara Plett-Usher. Long and meaningful. That's how Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky described Wednesday's phone call with the President of China, Xi Jinping. It's the first contact they've had since Russia invaded Ukraine over a year ago and comes a month after President Xi paid a two-day state visit to Moscow. Beijing has sought to appear neutral on the invasion but has never hidden its close ties to Russia or condemned the war. Yu Jun is from the Foreign Ministry in Beijing.
The Chinese government will send a special representative on Eurasian affairs to visit Ukraine and other countries to conduct in-depth communication with all parties for a political settlement of the Ukrainian crisis.
I've been speaking to our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, and to our correspondent in Kyiv, James Waterhouse.
Kyiv is seeing this as a diplomatic breakthrough. Just last month, President Zelensky once again signalled his willingness to speak with Xi Jinping. He even invited him to Kyiv after the Chinese leader visited Vladimir Putin in Moscow, but he didn't end up taking that invitation. Nevertheless, we're told they spoke for more than an hour and that there was some substance to it. What Kyiv is looking to do here, Alex, is strengthen its ties with Beijing. So there were discussions around that, but Beijing reiterated its stance on Russia's invasion. China has refused to condemn this war to date. If anything, it's strengthened economic ties with Russia. Today, we're told that Beijing reiterated that negotiations and talks are the only ways out of this conflict. While Volodymyr Zelensky welcomed this conversation, he once again reiterated his stance, which was that peace can only come without any kind of territorial compromise. What Ukraine wants is a military victory to avoid that very thing. So it is nevertheless progress for Kyiv as it sees it. But what this will do in terms of the geopolitics of this war, I think we'll have to wait.
Celia, why has it taken China so long to have these talks with Ukraine?
That's a really good question, Alex. It could be that he's had some recent diplomatic success in brokering unlikely ties now between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Beijing took credit for fostering those talks. There's also an economic side to all of this. For a while, China could absorb the economic pain of the Russian invasion into Ukraine. However, as the war drags on, it's really starting to have an impact on China's own economy, too. And also, there are some people who think, well, we've seen that as this war has been going on, Xi Jinping's worst nightmare is coming true in some ways. He's seeing that Europe and the United States are getting even closer than they were before. And that's not what he wants. He wants to drive a wedge between Europe and the US. So by becoming more actively involved in trying to negotiate a settlement to the end of this war, perhaps he can set the course straight again and foster greater ties with Europe.
It's portraying itself as a trusted mediator, but Chinese media on the war generally shows the Russian viewpoint. Surely not many people are going to take that seriously.
Yeah, many people have been questioning that for quite some time. We are seeing a bit of an interesting change in tone, though, in today's Chinese state media with the report of this phone call between Xi and Zelensky. Quite a straight readout of the call, but a lengthy readout. China's interpretation of the call, expressing the 31 years of warm relations between the two countries, that kind of thing. It's actually been met with quite a lot of applause on Chinese social media platforms. One of the comments I read said, China must break the deadlock and melt the ice. So Chinese people really seem to be looking to Beijing to try to be the country that really puts an end to this war.
James, was this a one-off conversation or could there be more of this to come?
You know, what Ukraine doesn't want is for Russia and China to be working more in tandem as this war drags on. So I think we could well see more interactions, but I still think China will be looking to engage with Russia as the bigger party here. It's given Vladimir Putin diplomatic cover by not condemning the war, but could these be the signs of China looking to play the field a bit more? Who knows?
James Waterhouse in Kyiv, and we also heard from Celia Hatton. A writer who accuses the former US President Donald Trump of raping her has told a New York court that she's suing him to try to get her life back. E. Jean Carroll alleges that he attacked her in a department store in the 1990s and then lied about it. Mr. Trump has strongly denied the accusations, writing on social media that the civil case is a scam and a witch hunt. From New York, here's our correspondent Neda Torfik.
Within minutes of taking the stand, E. Jean Carroll said she was there because Donald Trump raped her, lied about it, and shattered her reputation. She acknowledged that she was unable to recall the exact date of the incident, a point Mr. Trump's lawyers have seized on. But she described the alleged attack in explicit detail, saying she could still remember the feel of the extreme pain today. She became emotional as she told the jury that the very fact that she walked into that fitting room with Donald Trump still plagued her, but that she was also proud that she got out. Initially, Ms. Carroll said the encounter was a funny New York scene and the two were joking and flirting, but then it quickly turned as Mr. Trump shoved her against the wall of a dressing room and forced himself on her. She said she never screamed and doesn't recall saying no, but that she pushed him back, making it clear she didn't want anything else to happen. She told the court that she never reported it because she felt ashamed and was afraid of losing her job. Donald Trump's lawyers will later have a chance to challenge her on the stand during cross-examination.
Neda Torfik in New York. The number of people who starved themselves to death in a cult in Kenya, believing that they would go to heaven, has risen to 98. Authorities have been uncovering mass graves in an area of the Chakola forest not far from the Kenyan coast, where the Good News International Church was based. Pastor Paul Mackenzie Ntenge, the group's leader, is in custody. Matthias Chapita is from Haki Africa, the human rights group who received a tip-off and led the police to the site a week ago. James Copnell asked him to describe what he's witnessed, and some listeners may find this interview distressing.
It's very horrific. It's one of the worst massacres we've ever seen in our country. The worst thing is that it is connecting to a religion or a cult or a teaching that is actually leading people to suicide. Seeing bodies of children, 5, 4 in one grave together with their fathers or mothers is really devastating. A whole generation of young people or children have been wiped out in this area. This is genocide, the Minister of Interior in Kenya yesterday said, because members of one religion were actually killed. A majority of those who died are Christians. They were brainwashed in such a way that they believed that they would be going to heaven. The pastor professes the faith that the world is coming to an end in the month of August. So the pastor himself does not fast. He makes the people fast. And when they die, he prays for them. And then he says that he will be the last, so that he can be able to pray for the ones who are dying. So this is demonic. I have never seen this in my whole life as a human rights activist.
I can really imagine the sense of shock. Is it sadly possible that there may be more graves that haven't been discovered yet?
The whole 800-acre piece of land, there are some portions that are believed to be where the graves are. We have started with where the mass graves are, and we are not really sure how many graves we'll meet because the graves are shallow graves. You cannot really tell whether you are standing on a graveyard or whether it's just a normal area of land. So you can't really tell. We've requested more air surveillance, low-flying helicopters, to actually be able to rescue more victims who continue fasting. Even as we speak, even as we continue with exhumation, we continue receiving more people who are actually still fasting.
Wow. Give us a sense of the sort of impact this has had in the area and I guess more broadly in Kenya.
It's really shocking. When we whistleblowed on this, we'd never thought that it would be to this extent, but the whole country is mourning because the faithfuls of the people who are professing this religion are coming from several parts of the country. Some have traveled many kilometers to be able to be at that village called Chakahola. And the villages are named in the name of cities in the Bible. Some are Jerusalem, some are Babylon, Galilee. This was believed to be a holy land, and it's shocking many Kenyans. We had never seen a massacre of this nature.
Matthias Chapita from Haki Africa speaking to James Copnell. Think of a $69 billion takeover, and you'd probably assume it involved a banking, oil or food multinational. But you'd be wrong. That's the eye-watering figure Microsoft is offering to buy the computer games firm Activision Blizzard, the American makers of hit titles including the Call of Duty series and Candy Crush. The deal can only go ahead if approved by regulators in the US, the European Union and the UK. But the British Competition and Markets Authority, or CMA, has said no, which could stop the biggest ever deal in gaming history. Our gaming correspondent Stefan Powell reports.
Get ready, team. We have never seen a war zone like this.
Call of Duty. World of Warcraft.
Delicious.
And Candy Crush. Games which are loved by millions. They're made by Activision Blizzard, which is wanted by Microsoft. Owning these titles would put the technology giant in a strong position to encourage more players to choose its devices and services in years to come. The deal, though, is on life support, all because it's been judged by the CMA to reduce innovation and restrict competition in the fast-developing market for cloud gaming, where games are streamed from the internet rather than downloaded and played on devices. The news hasn't gone down well, with Activision saying in a statement that the decision was a disservice to UK citizens. Microsoft accused the CMA of having a flawed understanding of the market. Both firms have said they will appeal. Microsoft's Xbox console may be lagging behind Sony PlayStation in terms of sales, but the company does have a big presence in cloud gaming already, which is why the CMA reached this conclusion. Martin Coleman is the chair.
It would have had every incentive to keep those games to them itself, not offer those games to other competing gaming platforms, and that would have undermined the growth of this really important, developing, dynamic market.
The deal needs approval in the UK, the EU and the US to go ahead. So today's decision, the first from any of those jurisdictions, could scupper the merger. But it's not over yet. The UK's Competition Appeal Tribunal will have the final say here, a process that could take several months.
Tasty.
Stefan Powell. Still to come, the big debate about the future of the British monarchy ahead of the coronation of King Charles III.
Yeah, you still have a king and queen, and you probably have the Prince of Wales as well. You'd have to choose two out of three out of Balmoral, Buckingham Palace and Windsor.
What happened to Sandringham?
Oh, they're all gone, mate. We turned it into a hospital.
The New York Stock Exchange suspended trading in the struggling US bank First Republic on Wednesday after its share price fell by more than 20%. At the start of this year, shares were trading at more than $120. When the New York market closed, the price was less than $6. There are concerns First Republic could become the next lender to fail following the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank along with Signature Bank last month. Our North America business correspondent Michelle Fleury told me the panic set in after First Republic revealed last month that it lost $100 billion in deposits.
It's that massive withdrawal figure that really sent investors fleeing for the exits. They reported their earnings on Monday, and that's when they disclosed just how many people have been pulling their money out of the bank. And that left many people scratching their heads, wondering, well, what then is the future for this bank? How does it stabilise itself? And that panic in turn has led to more people running for the exits and accelerating this kind of downward spiral for the company. Such was the speculation this morning. There was a report that the US government had declined to intervene in any rescue plan. All eyes turned to the major big US banks because you may recall the first time First Republic got in trouble, which was after the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank. The big US banks pumped in $30 billion to try and stabilise the bank. The question is, would they stick around perhaps and help this troubled bank out for a second time?
There are many factors at play here, of course, but what are the standout reasons for this trouble?
In some ways, it's similar to what we saw with Silicon Valley Bank. It has a lot of investments in assets that are sensitive to rising interest rates and that lost value when interest rates went up. And its wealthy customers
feared that their large balances wouldn't be covered by the deposit insurance if the bank had to be rescued. And so they've started pulling out their money. And it's this double whammy from both sides, this pincer effect, that is creating problems for the bank.
We all remember the meltdown in 2008 when the federal government didn't save Lehman Brothers and everything that followed after that. Is there a risk that this could happen again?
I think this is different to 2008, but that doesn't mean it can't cause damage to the broader US economy. And I think it's a reminder that this banking crisis that we're seeing right now isn't over.
Michelle Fleury in New York. The new United Nations envoy to Haiti has told a meeting of the UN Security Council that gang violence in the Caribbean nation is expanding at an alarming rate in areas previously considered safe. She was speaking just days after 13 suspected gang members were beaten and burned to death by a mob in the capital, Port-au-Prince. Here's our Latin America regional editor, Mimi Swaby.
The Haitian National Police and the UN said the number of reported violent crimes, including murders, rapes, kidnappings and lynchings, had more than doubled in the first quarter of this year. Addressing the Security Council meeting in her new role, Special Representative Maria Isabel Salvador emphasised her grave concern.
Since the last briefing to the Council by my predecessor in January, gang criminality has grown. Gang violence is expanding at an alarming rate in areas previously considered relatively safe in Port-au-Prince and outside the capital. The horrific violence in gang-ridden areas, including sexual violence, particularly against women and girls, is emblematic of the terror afflicting much of Haiti's population.
80% of Port-au-Prince is now under gang occupation. Blockades at fuel terminals has cut supply of basic goods. By June this year, the UN fears that half of Haitian people will be affected by acute food insecurity. Although a path to restoring democratic institutions was discussed at the meeting, many feel it would be difficult to move forward without effectively addressing the rampant insecurity first. The government promised to create a special multinational force in October last year. However, this is yet to materialise.
Mimi Swaby. There have been many cases where originators of an idea do not get the credit they deserve. One glaring example is that of Rosalind Franklin, one of the people who helped discover the famous double helix structure of the DNA molecule. Terry Egan reports.
DNA was discovered in 1869, but it took scientists more than 70 years to realise it contained a code for human life. The first step in that realisation was to work out its structure. And Cambridge scientists James Watson and Francis Crick were busily trying to build a 3D model of the molecule. That was when Rosalind Franklin made an X-ray diffraction image of DNA with her graduate student Raymond Gosling, which is known as Photograph 51. It revealed that it had a helix shape and supported other research she'd done into DNA. What happened next, though, changed everything. It's believed that one of her colleagues, Maurice Wilkins, secretly showed that image to Watson. And this, as well as Franklin's data, proved to be crucial. A seminal paper on DNA's double helix structure was published in 1953. And in 1962, 4 years after the death of Franklin, Watson, Crick and Wilkins were awarded a Nobel Prize. But in his phenomenally successful book, The Double Helix, James Watson appeared to imply that Franklin was unable to decipher what her own data were telling her. Here's Matthew Cobb, Professor of Zoology at the University of Manchester.
So Watson's account puts him at the centre of the story. I think probably the most fascinating thing we found was the programme from the Royal Society Conversazioni, its science exhibition that took place in the summer, 2 months after the three articles on DNA structure were published in Nature. And there, this first public presentation of the double helix is led by Rosalind Franklin.
Professor Cobb and others have found a draft news article written in consultation with Franklin that was never published, as well as an overlooked letter to Crick from one of Franklin's colleagues. The documents suggest she was well aware of what she was doing and fully understood the structure of DNA. It also overturns the image of her as a junior partner in the discovery. Rosalind Franklin was, say the researchers, up against not just the routine sexism of the day, but also more subtle forms embedded in science, some of which are still present today.
Terry Egan. The coronation in London of King Charles III is just days away, and the ceremony will very publicly attempt to underline the tradition of monarchy in Britain. Here on the BBC, we've held a debate about whether the country still needs a monarchy. It was chaired by my colleague Michelle Hussain. The other voices you'll hear are the Times columnist Juliet Samuels, the former Daily Telegraph editor Charles Moore, the singer and campaigner Billy Bragg, the Guardian newspaper columnist Polly Toynbee, and the Cambridge academic Jason Arday. Michelle asked the panel whether it mattered that comparable European monarchies were cheaper to run than Britain's.
I suppose you could engage in a fiscal operation of winding up the monarchy, and you could disperse all of its assets to rational places, and you could fold it into the state, and then what you'd be left with is essentially exactly the same fiscal situation, except that you would have done away with an institution that many people have huge affection for, which ties us to our past, which bonds us as a collective nation. And I don't think you'd end up feeling very good about that at the end of the day.
I think that's a different point, though. I think I'm making a relative point about the fact that our monarchy and royal family does seem to be more expensive than many of our neighbours on the continent. The cost of funding it, the cost to the taxpayer.
Actually, that isn't true, because to use a sort of disagreeable business expression, it washes its face. The tourist revenue that is attracted by the monarchy vastly, vastly exceeds what is paid out by the state. And actually, very little is paid out by the state because it comes from income from the Crown.
Tourist income doesn't. Yeah. And in fact, you know, Legoland down the road from Windsor gets much more. Versailles.
You people don't go to Versailles without a king.
No, of course you can do that, but it's certainly an attraction that you know that's where the king or queen lives. It undoubtedly is a big attraction.
Or lived.
They're changing the guard at Buckingham Palace. Christopher Robin went down with Alice. You know, it's all part of it.
Wait, Billy Bragg, in your system, where would they live? You'd still have a king and queen.
Well, yeah, you still have a king and queen, and you probably have the Prince of Wales as well. We could chip in a bit to that, I suppose, but they do have a lot of land and they do have a lot of income, so maybe they could pay their way a little bit more. They could probably, I'd get away, maybe, they'd have to choose two out of three out of Balmoral, Buckingham Palace and Windsor. Buckhouse would be the obvious one, because it's right.
What happened to Sandringham?
Oh, they're all gone, mate. We turn it into a hospital. That could be a hospital. You can choose out the big three.
Buckingham Palace is already a museum.
Yeah, but it's not 24-7, is it? You can't go down there any time.
You want it?
Can you go on the balcony?
No.
Oh, there you go. There's your problem. So...
And you can catch up on the debate on the BBC Sounds app. Staying with monarchy, the man who will conduct the orchestra at next week's coronation service at Westminster Abbey says the king has chosen music that will stir the soul. Sir Antonio Pappano, who's music director of the Royal Opera House, says the selections aim to represent and celebrate the diverse cultures of the UK and the Commonwealth. He's been speaking to our music correspondent, Mark Savage.
King Charles has personally chosen the music for his coronation service, which will include well-known works by Elgar and Handel, alongside new pieces by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Judith Weir. The conductor, Sir Antonio Pappano, says the music is intended to convey a message.
The King has chosen a programme that has obviously been meticulously planned in his mind for a long time. There are composers of colour, there are women composers, a diverse orchestra. But these are not things that are ticking boxes. I think that the King has a vision of what we are culturally.
Sir Antonio will conduct an orchestra featuring members from 8 ensembles from across the Commonwealth. He admits it's a daunting task.
I will be with the orchestra in the organ loft with the organist, but the choir will be downstairs. Special scaffolding will have been built for the extra fanfare orchestra. You can imagine it's going to be very challenging, potentially very exciting.
The service will begin at 11 a.m. on Saturday, the 6th of May.
Mark Savage with that report. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by David Evans, and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
When the cost of living rises, how you invest matters even more. A financial advisor can help you make sense of it all. Now's the time to invest with advice. Visit dynamic.ca/advice to learn more.